Last week, a friend from Calvary delivered me some donuts that I say she's a good friend. And any friend who delivers donuts can almost always have a hug. So while she was delivering the donuts, she said, "You know, Dan, last week I was listening to a preacher on the radio, and I thought for sure it was you. He was saying, just imagine that Jesus lived in your house." That's kind of been a theme lately. What would that be like if Jesus lived in your house? If you had a migraine, he'd come over and touch your forehead and you'd feel all better. And if your dog died, he'd come over and place a hand on your dog and bring Rover back to life. And if your cat died, he would help you bury it. Thank you, Joyce. That one has absolutely nothing to do with the message this weekend other than the fact that it made me laugh. And it's good to laugh. If you were with us a bit ago, you know it's good to laugh. I love to laugh at church. Ask people to describe church, and often the words that come to mind are boring and irrelevant and boring. I mean, when's the last time you heard, "Hey, I'm going to have a great party at my house this weekend? Man, I'm inviting a group of pastors and their closest friends." When I was a kid, I said it all the time. "I don't want to go to church. It's boring." But here's the deal. Jesus often said that the kingdom of heaven is like a party, a celebration, a factory of joy. And Christ calls us to live a life that invites people to the party. And I wonder if our most urgent message isn't simply, don't miss the party. Don't miss the party. I'm so glad that you're connecting with us this week, wherever you find yourself and however you found us. And for those of you who sent me an email last week, man, thank you. Reading them was one of the highlights of my week. Darlene from Smicksburg and Earl from Kansas and Steve from Grass Valley, California, Carolyn from North Carolina, Gina from Florida, Nick from Boston. I spent time praying for you this week, asking God to pour joy, His joy into your heart, praying that God would amaze you as only He can do. I'm praying for you the same thing that I'm praying for the whole Calvary family, all of you connecting, that we just don't miss the party. Don't miss the party, because in the midst of all the difficulty, in the midst of whatever you're going through now, don't forget this. One time Jesus was asked, "What is the kingdom of God really like?" And Jesus' answer was, "The kingdom of God is like a wedding reception, a party," right? In Jesus' day, wedding receptions were not an obligation. They were a ridiculously lavish celebration that often involved the whole community and went on for days, not hours. And the kingdom of heaven is like a wedding celebration. C.S. Lewis once said, "Joy is the serious business of heaven." I'm not saying that we don't go through tough times. We've gone through some really tough times, hard times in the last 15 months. And I've prayed for more people who have lost loved ones and done and gone to more funerals than any year in recent memory. We've walked through some tough days. I was in Minneapolis last year, the day that George Floyd was killed. I've prayed with Osagie Osagie's father. I prayed with and for police officers whose hearts have been broken in this last year. It's been one of the hardest years of ministry that I've ever led through. People at Calvary have gone through financial uncertainty, mental health issues. Some marriages didn't make it through the quarantine, and some are still wrestling through. But in the midst of all the trouble, Jesus is still the author and the finisher of my faith. He's still the Son of God who dove into the mess to bring us, to gift us with an overflowing joy, joy in the midst of the difficulty. Listen, as hard as any season we go through might be, if we really believe that the best is yet to come, then a personal relationship with a good, joyful, all-powerful, all-loving Creator should rub off a bit at least, right? I love how the prophet Isaiah describes this joyful God in Isaiah 29, verses 13 through 14. He says, "These people come near to me with their mouth and they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship of me is based on merely human rules that they've been taught. Therefore," he says, "once more, I will astound them with wonder upon wonder." God is bummed out because people's hearts are all bricked up, all hard, and they're dry, and their worship is filled with dry rules and regulations. There's no joy. There's no wonder. There's no fun. So what does God decide to do? He says, "Therefore, once more, I will astound these people with wonder upon wonder." In other words, I'm going to blow their minds. I'm going to knock their socks off. I'm going to bring a smile to their faces if it's the last thing I do. Can you imagine God saying that? And God will do that. He loves to do that. years ago, my son Josh is probably about 8 years old. He's going to get married now in a few months. He was sitting in church listening to me preach, and Josh at that time was asking all kinds of questions. He did it in movies, he did it in sermons, asking Lynn all kinds of questions about what I was saying, and finally she leaned over and said, "Shh, Josh, I'm missing everything that Daddy is saying." And so he is quiet for a while. And at some point, Lynn looked back over at him, and he had his head in his hands. And so she just reached over and scratched his back. And he looked up, this huge grin on his face. And he said, "Mom, do you know what just happened? I prayed, 'God, if you really hear my prayers, would you make my mom reach over and scratch my back in 2 minutes and 10 seconds? And I counted, and right when I got to 130, you reached over and scratched my back." God astounded him with a wonder. You know, when I look back over my life, there's one story after another of the times when God astounded me with a wonder. I could tell you about the time God gave my family an unexpected pod of dolphins as we snorkeled in a bay. I could tell you about emails received which share stories of life transformation, hope reborn, a marriage restored. I could tell you about the birth of each of my kids. I could tell you about walking through dark days with nothing but the joy of Jesus set before us as a motivation to keep going. In my life, he has astounded me with wonder upon wonder. And somehow, somewhere, we've gotten this odd notion that to be truly spiritual is to be terminally gloomy. We paint Christianity in black and white when our relationship with Jesus is meant to be shown in living color, 3D living color. You know, the Bible talks a lot about joy. And in fact, it would be easy to argue that joy is at the very heart of God's plan for humanity. In Psalm 16:11, the psalmist writes, "God, you will show me the way of life, granting me the joy of your presence and the pleasures of living with you forever." John Ortberg writes, "God is the happiest being in the universe. God also knows sorrow, but the sorrow of God is a temporary response to a fallen world. The sorrow will be banished one day when the world is set right, but joy is God's basic character. Joy is God's eternal destiny. God," Ortberg writes, "is the happiest being in the universe." And perhaps few things are more essential for the life that we long to live than the essential of joy. Unexplainable, uncontainable, contagious, and outrageous joy. And again, I'm not talking about a pain-free existence. I'm not talking about getting everything I want when I want it. I'm not even talking about God changing my circumstances. It's often what we think that needs to happen for joy is our circumstances to change. But this isn't circumstantial happiness. It's deeper, more solid, and more exhilarating. It can produce laughter. Gut busting can't stop at laughter, but you can't define it as a laugh. It doesn't require a closed-eye approach to a reality, but it may require a new look at life. It requires an understanding that joy is a gift from God. That's what Paul is saying in Romans 5:13 when he writes, "May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit." See, joy is a gift from God, and nobody does joy like God. I love the story that Tim Hansel tells of an 82-year-old man who felt that his freedom to choose joy had been taken away from him. He had served as a pastor for over 50 years, but in the last handful of years, he had struggled with skin cancer so bad that he'd already had 15 operations. And besides suffering from the pain, he was so embarrassed about how the cancer had scarred his appearance that he hardly ever went out in public. And then one day, he was given the book, You Gotta Keep Dancing. And he read the story of Tim Hansel's long struggle with the chronic, intense pain he received from a near-fatal climbing accident. Hansel told of the day he realized that this pain would be with him forever. And at that moment, he made a pivotal decision. He knew that it was up to him to choose how he responded to this pain, his circumstances. And so he decided to choose joy. This elderly pastor put the book down thinking, "That guy's crazy. You can't just choose joy." Then later he was reading John 15:11, where Jesus says that joy is a gift. I want to give you my joy, Jesus says, so that your joy may be complete. Your joy will overflow. And he didn't know what to do, so he just got down on his knees in his living room and he said, "Well then, Lord, give it to me. And suddenly, as this 82-year-old former pastor described it, this incredible hunk of joy just came from heaven and landed on him. I was overwhelmed, he wrote. It was like the joy talked about in Peter, joy unspeakable and full of glory. I didn't know what to say, so I said, "Turn it on, Lord, turn it on." And before he knew it, he was dancing around the house. He felt so joyful that he actually felt born again, 82, and he's so filled with joy, he just had to get out. Too much joy to keep corked up. So he went to the local fast food restaurant to get a burger, and this lady serving saw how happy he was and asked, "How are you doing?" He said, "I'm wonderful." "Is it your birthday?" she asked. "No, honey, it's better than that." "Your anniversary, better than that." "Well, what is it?" she asked with this kind of growing excitement in her. He said, "It's the joy of Jesus. Do you know what I'm talking about?" And the lady shrugged, kind of deflated and answered, "No, I have to work on Sundays." Can I find joy if I have to work on Sundays? Can joy be a part of my life if my life is filled with pain? Years ago, I officiated a wedding for some family members, and Kelsey, the bride, when I gave my very first sermon at my very first church, this was over 30-some years ago, she was 4 years old, and she was there for my very first sermon. And in that church, when the preacher was done preaching, he would walk down the aisle before everyone else got up so that he could greet everybody at the door. So here I am, very first sermon, young, insecure preacher. And Kelsey and her parents are in the third row of this little church. Kelsey's standing up on the pew right beside her dad. And just as I'm walking past, she went, "Wow, I'm glad that's finally over." and I kind of stopped in my tracks. Nobody in the church knew whether to laugh or just kind of look away in embarrassment. And I looked at her, big smile on my face. I said, "Me too, Kelsey, me too." And everyone laughed. And there was joy. And so I loved standing at the front of the aisle and watching this young man's face as he watched Kelsey coming down the aisle. The joy was just leaking out his eyes, leaking out his smile. But can I find joy if my marriage is just ending rather than just starting? Can joy be a part of my life when it feels like I'm just marking time, waiting for something to be over? Jesus said in John 15:11, "I have told you these things so that you will be filled with my joy." Yes, your joy will overflow. Your joy will overflow. Ask yourself, when is the last time I had a joy flood? You know, we get floods in our basements and floods at the beach, floods from hurricanes, but when is the last time you had a joy flood, overflowing joy, like you just can't keep it in? And if you know the life circumstance of Jesus' followers at the time that Jesus made that promise about overflowing joy, you know that it was not a pain-free, trouble-free season. It was a time that was filled with trouble. Can we have overflowing joy in times of great trouble? Only if it's a gift. Only if there's a source of joy that runs deeper than our circumstances. Only if the best is yet to come. And joy is just a deposit, a taste of the best that's yet to come. So we're looking today at Jesus' very first miracle in John chapter 2. If you have your Bibles, you can turn there. If not, the scripture will be on the screen too. John calls it a sign. It's not just a miracle. It's a sign. A sign is an act that points to something more, that says something is coming. It reveals something. It points us toward and reveals something about Jesus. And I believe that we'll see this act is all about joy and life and celebrations and how to go about finding life at the party, finding life at the party. So listen to the first part of the story in John chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Here's what it says. On the third day, a wedding took place in Cana of Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Now, I want you to imagine this. In those days, a father had to start preparing for his daughter's wedding day, the day she was born. The average cost for a wedding last year in America was a bit more than $20,000, which was down significantly from pre-COVID averages. But a wedding in those days was not a one-night party with a small invite list. A wedding in those days was a community event that could last for days. So imagine the owner of the vineyard, every year since his daughter was born, they'd crush the grapes and make the wine, and one barrel would be set back for his daughter's wedding. Girls usually get married by 15 or 16, so a good father might have 16 barrels of wine some of it now aged to a fine wine. They'd start with those, the fine wine, the best comes out first. But this particular wedding party involves a wedding emergency, a party embarrassment. Jesus' mother, Mary, comes to Jesus and says, they've got no more wine. As another pastor said, with those words, Mary speaks a truth about our lives, a truth that at some point we all experience. Listen closely. There comes a day when the wine gives out, and the glass is empty, the party is over. And on that day, life seems empty and dry. There's no vibrancy, there's no vitality, there's no flourishing or thriving. The bouquet of life is absent, and we're living less than fully alive. Jesus compared the kingdom of heaven to a wedding party. But even beyond that, biblically, all through the Old Testament, especially the prophet Isaiah, the image of wine brings to mind the joy and abundance of life with God. The Bible clearly critiques the misuse of wine, but the prophet Isaiah tells us that one of the marks of the Messiah is that he'll rescue us from hardship and provide for us a feast full of rich food and well-aged wine. In other words, in the midst of our difficulty, he will provide joy. When the wine runs dry, he will provide joy. He'll be the life of your party. So let me just ask you, has your wine run dry? I mean, maybe you don't even realize it yet. Ask the people around you, has my wine run dry? Have you lost the joy? Everything seems a bit harder, a bit drier. Maybe not depressed, maybe not burnt out, but languishing. Not thriving. I would guess everybody here could tell a story about the day the wine ran dry. It might involve a marriage that's lost its joy or the death of a loved one. It might involve a betrayal of a friend or a wilderness search for community or wrestling with failure. I know people who would tell stories of regret or fear. And some don't even know the story. They just have this indescribable longing for an unnamed something more. When in reality, the wine has run dry. You know what? In my youth, I thought that when the wine ran dry, I could always fill my cup on my own. Just work harder, think smarter, laugh louder, be first more often, achieve more, get recognition, vindication, success. These last few years, especially these last few months, I've discovered that the wine running dry is less about my circumstances, less about what I can do, and more about my heart. The cure isn't found in the illusion of my self-sufficiency, but in the reality of God's gracious provision. See, I found that there's no need for a miracle till the wine runs out. And in that way, perhaps running out of wine, man, maybe that's a good thing. We're all looking for a miracle. Everybody wants to be part of a miracle, but every miracle starts with a problem. We don't even ask God for a miracle until we realize that we can't fill our own cup. See, the first step to finding joy may be to admit that the wine has run dry and we can't fill it back up. We can't bring it back. We can't make it work. Can't fill it up, at least not on my own. So Mary goes to Jesus. Jesus, the wine has run dry. And the conversation continues in John 2, verses 4 and 5. Jesus says, "Woman, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come." But his mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, Jesus sounds almost disrespectful in this moment, but he's not. The language of that day between parent and child was often more formal. And Jesus is not saying, "Leave me alone. Mary, leave me alone. Get out of here." Mary is asking for a miracle, and Jesus is simply saying, "It's not time yet. It's not time for the miracles. It's not time for people to begin to wonder about me. My hour has not yet come. I have a business that's more important than miracles. It's not my time." But Mary won't stop. The wine has run dry. She cares about these people and this wedding embarrassment. It's a joy emergency. And so she looks at the servants and she says, "Just do whatever he tells you to do." Here's another principle, and this one is so key. If we want joy, if we want to live our one and only life overflowing with joy, a flood of joy, don't miss this principle. When the wine is run dry and you come to Jesus, we can ask for anything as long as we are willing to surrender everything. Mary told the servants, "Just do whatever he tells you to do." Are you willing to do whatever he tells you to do? See, this is an issue of surrender. Am I willing to surrender control? Am I willing to surrender leadership, my ideas, my agenda? When we ask for a miracle, we honor God's hand by the size of our request, but we honor his heart by our willingness to do whatever he asks. Do you trust him? Ask yourself, what am I willing to surrender for joy? And surrender is key because ultimately surrender is the stairway that brings us deeper into relationship with Jesus. And it's his presence, not the actual miracle. It's his presence that brings joy. Do whatever he says. Mary comes with her request, but she leaves it in Jesus' hands. She trusts his heart. In this moment, she is surrendered. We can ask for anything as long as we're willing to surrender everything. Ask whatever you want as long as you're willing to do whatever he asks. Willing to surrender everything. Some of you know, if you've been connecting with us this last year, how God has been dealing with me in this area. First, he's just given me this deep desire for new wine in the church, a new chapter, new joy, new power, new life, new story. I've often talked about these things in terms of personal renewal and corporate revival and an awakening in our neighborhoods to the love and reality of Christ in so many different ways. It's the church that has run out of wine. And I so long to see the church filled again, bringing life and joy to neighborhoods all over the country. Back in March of 2020, Jesus started me on a surrender journey. First, in the midst of my worst night of COVID-19, I sensed God asking me to surrender control. In those moments, I was so worried about what I needed to be doing as a leader, but I couldn't because I was sick and just feeling terrible. And I just sensed God saying, be still. Surrender control. Let your hands grow slack. What you've desired, I sensed him saying, what you've desired, I'm doing. But only if you surrender control. Soon after that, he wasn't done. It was a second area of surrender. He said, Dan, I want you to surrender the crowds. Man, that's kind of what I've lived for. What I've measured for success is how large is the crowd at Calvary. But even then there was more. The trifecta was, Dan, I want you to surrender your voice. And I'm still trying to figure out what that one means. But all I know is that he's asked this leader, preacher, church builder to surrender control, surrender the crowds, and surrender my voice. And I'm just thinking, other than my family, what else do I really have? What would it mean for you to be willing to ask him for anything but surrender to him in everything? The story continues in John 2, verses 6 through 10. It says, nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by Jews for the ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the very brim. And then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He didn't realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. And then he called the bridegroom aside. He said, you know, everyone brings out the choice wine, the fine wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now. Six stone water jars holding about 150 gallons of water. And when the master of the banquet gives it the taste test, he realized that what they thought was good wine in the beginning is nothing compared to the wine bottled under Christ's label. And this is both a miracle of quantity and quality. 150 gallons is about 768 bottles of fine wine. Hashtag OMG, so much and so good. But remember, this is not just a miracle, it's a sign. It's an act revealing something about Jesus. And at least part of the message is that Jesus offers. He offers above and beyond joy. It's not a bare minimum joy. It's not enough joy to just get by. When we uncork the joy of Jesus, I'm telling you, it's going to go beyond your expectations, both in quantity and quality. So don't miss the party. Don't miss the party that comes when you find Jesus and the Spirit of God is let loose in your life. If you believe in Jesus, you will get so full of life that barrels of joy will gush out from you. And Jesus loved life and he was filled with joy. Can you even imagine Jesus making 768 bottles of wine without a little bit of a joy twinkle in his eye? I got to tell you, when Jesus walked the earth, And he knew how to party. And don't hear what I'm not saying. Some of you have been going to parties where the alcohol has flowed freely, but the wine of your heart has run dry. You went looking for life. You pour every moment into what you do looking for life. You make decisions because you're looking for life. But listen, Jesus didn't go to parties looking for life. Wherever he was, there was a party because he had life to give. He has life to give, and he gives life and joy to everyone who asks. Even in the most difficult of times, there's joy. John closes his story with these words in verse 11. John 2:11, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. He revealed his glory. The first of the signs where he revealed his glory, the glory to come. He revealed that he is the joy giver. And honestly, the question for you is, do I believe in him like the disciples? Do I believe in him? And am I ready for new wine? You know, each one of us, every person listening to this, each one of you, all of us, we're in one of three camps. Either you've gone through difficult times, or you're going through difficult times, or difficult times are coming. None of us are going to miss them. In the days to come, Jesus' friends would go through such trouble, heart-wrenching, soul-stretching, friendship-breaking times. But in the midst of it all, you read the book of Acts and you find them singing in prison and forgiving while being beaten, generously sacrificing for those who persecuted them while living with this deep, deep, deep joy. And sometimes that joy, sometimes that new wine, it comes from a water into wine miracle. But you know this is true. More often it comes in the very, you know how wine is made, in the very stomping, crushing, pressing process. Madeleine L'Engle once said, I don't envy those who have never known pain, physical or spiritual, because I strongly suspect that the capacity for pain and the capacity for joy are equal. Only those who have suffered great pain are able to know equally great joy. All I know is that joy is one of our most powerful connectors to the presence of God. God created us for joy. And our problem is not that our desire for joy is too weak. It's that our pursuit of joy is found in things that at best brings momentary happiness. You know, I believe, I hope deep in my heart, I'm expectant that Jesus is bringing his church right now through a transition, that you and I are headed into a next new chapter, new wine. But it may take some crushing, some pressing. It'll definitely take surrender. So listen to this song. And as you listen to the song, ask God for some new wine. Ask God for some joy. Both for you personally, for your home, for your family, for our church, for our communities. Say, God, no matter what it takes, no matter what I have to surrender, would you fill us up? Would you fill us up?